This is GeekSpeak, episode 43 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. Hi, Miles.
How's it going, Lyle?
Quite well, thank you. A little update from last week. We've been talking about the Note 7, the Galaxy Note 7. We talked about how it was going to be discontinued, and this day we recorded, totally discontinued. And additionally, it has now been rated as officially banned by the Federal Aviation Administration. You cannot bring a Galaxy Note 7 onto a plane at all.
It is suddenly considered a greater threat than more than a few ounces of shampoo.
Yes, that's right. It's more dangerous than shampoo. So order number FAA 2016-9288 on Friday, which states that as of noon of October 15th, flyers are prohibited from bringing the device onto any aircraft. The order restricts passengers from carrying the phone on their person, in carry-on luggage, in checked baggage, or as cargo. Basically, no. That no longer. The Galaxy Note 7 is completely recalled, and you get a little bit of money back when you return it. And we've seen a complete failure in this regard, which is interesting to see such a massive problem of this nature. Really sad for the amount of resources that has gone into this. And I don't think anyone's actually died, but people have burned from it, you know, gotten small injuries. But more
not so small injuries.
Pretty serious injuries?
There have been burns, like even skin grafts, yeah.
It's also the impact, well, on the world, you know. There's this large waste factor. These things are, even if they're recycled, it's definitely a loss from a resource perspective, just a big failure.
But then our consumerism, buying a new phone every 2 years is
also kind of waste.
Kind of like that, yeah.
But these things even get utility out of them, right?
Right.
And of course, it adds to people's concern and fear about technology, which is one of the things we try to fight here on the show. And
they will be able to reclaim the lithium.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the bigger items that needs to be recycled.
So tell me about HTTPS. I mean, not about, you know, we all know what it is. It's secure HTTP protocol, hypertext transfer protocol, secure mode.
The Firefox web browser keeps telemetry information. Actually, I'm sure other browsers do. I'm pretty sure Chrome did as well. But Firefox is a lot more transparent about that telemetry information. And a developer firm, Mozilla, showed a graph of page loads from Firefox in general, comparing HTTP to HTTPS, secure versus unsecure.
Across all Firefox users?
All Firefox users that are agreeing to show their usage patterns and telemetry data.
Well, that's a slightly skewed subset of the users. I mean, I'm assuming that more technically savvy people are like, yeah, I'll go ahead and share my telemetry data.
Right.
But in any case,
I think it might be checked by default when you install it, but they do talk about it.
And okay.
Or I'm not sure, but it's kind
of like, what's
the
numbers?
This makes it better. HTTPS is now 50% of the traffic.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
How fast has that grown?
Might say not fast enough, but it used to be, you know, half, like so a third of the traffic, and then HTTPS was more than that just 2 years ago.
It's pretty cool. It's 50. I'm curious how much of the traffic is individual websites that are now being, providing HTTPS through the free methodologies that exist now, or if it's that a lot more people are using Netflix, YouTube, and Gmail, and therefore that's an increase because those you can't get access to those without HTTPS.
Yeah. Well, it's been a steady increase. So, yeah.
Hey, I a while ago was kind of involved in a Hackday project with regards to messenger bots, and I've been actually, you know, I got the Echo, the Alexa Echo, at my house and use it quite a bit. Saw a great little post. I'll read it in a little bit. A comic that I saw about bots, but in general, bots have been extremely successful in the place where you have a public figure that wants to have some kind of feedback to a large audience. An example of that is the White House, specifically Barack Obama, and the whitehouse.gov has created a bot to represent Obama. And they made this very public that there was a bot representing him. And that project that actually runs, I think, on top of Drupal is now open source. They decided to make it open source. And the statement they made about that is that they said that they wanted help other government entities build their own bots to provide information to individuals. What do you think?
I think it's wonderful that instead of giving a canned answer and trying to walk away from that. They're saying, hey, we're trying to promote canned answers.
Well, do you think of it as a canned answer kind of thing? I mean, would you prefer prefer to have an artifice of this nature respond to you, or would you prefer to be ignored? Like, it's because, of course, if he can't answer everything, they can't answer every query.
It's not like this bot is getting information that isn't available elsewhere. So from my standpoint, it's like I could, you know, look it up and, you know, look at the whitehouse.gov website and probably find the exact same information. But, you know, I'm not going to poo-poo giving more information. Anytime the government tries to give more information about policy choices and stuff like that, the better. But
another note about this is that though you think of a bot as a respondent, one of the core features that this bot does is adds the input that gets sent through Messenger into the normal correspondence that goes to the president. So every day the president gets letters and emails, and of course a lot of it is filtered by staff, but then the president has a stack of things he can read through. And this bot was designed to feed into that system. So as people read it, it was part of the potential correspondence with the president. So it does more than that. Of course, also,
fair enough,
it takes that and make sure that it's part of the presidential history and part of the library that will emerge for Obama. So there's some features of it that are kind of neat from a just receiving data cleanly and easily, since so many people are using Messenger. I kind of like that aspect. So my first thing was like, ugh. And my second thought was, oh, that's clever, right?
Yeah.
Another way of communication.
No, it's good. I have to get past my own little prejudices of like, it's written in PHP. But
No. Kidding. It's worse than that. It's written in Drupal.
Drupal, yeah.
I mean, so Drupal is a web framework similar to WordPress. They're both PHP-based web applications that are content management systems, blogging systems, basically. Drupal has this this benefit in the sense that it has a very large complexity behind it. Didn't I hire you at UCSC to do Drupal development at one point?
Yeah.
How was that for you? You quit your job. We remained friends, so it wasn't that bad.
No, I got some stuff done. It was a bit spaghetti code in there. The additions that had already been made to it, so it was a little hard to get around. But yeah.
You're saying the work that I had done was bad? That's what you're saying? Thank you so much. Did I cover this last week that I've been for quite a while? Al Lucka, who's a former geek and sometimes comes on, and I work on Steve Wozniak's website, mm-hmm. Woz.org, and that's a Drupal site. Mm-hmm. That was my choice. I'm sorry.
But the thing is, I'm making jokes about this because there are valid reasons to use PHP. One, PHP has become so much better in more recent years. A lot of my prejudice against it comes from the earlier years, earlier versions of it. And in addition to that, as a programmatic model, just like a clean slate, you start over again each time.
Yeah.
There are more performant solutions for that. But at the same time, for what it does, it's a useful solution. The API has improved, and that wasn't hard because it's hard to make an API that was worse than PHP a few years back. But
yeah,
that's
– You know, Facebook runs on a souped-up version of PHP.
Yeah, PHP that gets compiled to C++.
Yeah.
Well, and then compiled, yeah.
Yeah. The trouble with these systems that allow you to do a lot of configuration and have levels of abstraction that help you do that, like plugins and modules and things of that nature, is that over time they age and you have to continually maintain them. So I spend a couple days a year on Woz's site, over mm-hmm. 2 hour spans. Anytime a security update happens, I make sure to update it. And it's behind a caching layer, so no individual users actually see it. We protect that. So that helps a lot on the security aspect. That means that there's a private web page location and which we log in and use to edit stuff, and then a front-end website. So when you go to Woz.org, you actually hit a HTML cache of the back-end system.
Sure.
There's no way to actually access the database from that direction, unless it's being published that way. In any case, though, the modification I wanted to do this last week was simply make a slideshow of all the events that Woz has done in the last couple of years. His wife asked for us to get that on the website. So if you go to woz.org right now, you'll see a banner image of him. And below that picture is a little ability to paginate through. You can click on it and kind of see multiple pictures. It's not auto-rotating. We put the site up 6 years ago.
It's been 6 years?
I think so.
You first showing it to me going like, hey, look what we did.
Yeah, I think so. It's up on the site too. I always make notes about that in the design area. But the trouble is that that's a Drupal 6 site. Drupal's now up at Drupal 8. The migration path is actually like install the new version and then point it to the old one with permissions special, and then it will suck in, slurp stuff in. But I've made custom views and custom stuff that did things, and all those things won't really merge over quite well. And it's just, it's not something that gives me joy in my life. If there's any Drupal developers out there that want to have the cred of helping Woz out, let me know. I'm Lyle at geekspeak.org. I'm probably very open and receptive to you participating. Here are the keys. No, but in all seriousness, I'm very happy to support Woz because he's awesome.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, so you want to do it?
No.
I'm
working on trying to get the GeekSpeak site.
I know. That's like,
patched up and have it. So we have these tools we're working on. We're going to talk about it after the show after show. But I got other fish to fry.
So Twitter for a long time hasn't been making money. Or I should say it makes money. It has staff. But there's this idea in the industry at large that it's not a success because it's not like Facebook and has taken over half the planet. So I use it regularly. In fact, a whole bunch of correspondence last week with Woz's site was all through Twitter and people had feedback and stuff. It's very useful. But there's always been this idea that Twitter would be purchased by some other entity.
Right.
Yahoo obviously is not that entity, considering Yahoo is doing very, very badly. But other people have been brought up as ideas.
Yeah, Google's been brought up, Apple, even Microsoft. But everyone seems to be going in different directions. First of all, Microsoft is now really pushing for the enterprise server market, and Twitter just doesn't fit that model well. One of the rumors or one of the suppositions is that Twitter is having a problem because of all the trolls that are on the site.
That is not a recent thing. That's a long-standing problem.
No, I'm talking about for purchasing. Having a problem getting a suitor that will pay what they consider a reasonable price for their infrastructure and their user base. And that was a big mantra, actually, was if you have the users, we'll pay the money. It doesn't matter. But
right.
There is enough problem on Twitter. Aditi was also mentioning as well this love-hate relationship. Like Twitter is this amazing thing that we've talked about where city governments have used it to make transparency happen for their municipality where city council notes can go on Twitter and then it's all right there. Police departments will put up their information on Twitter so that the information is right there. But you'll also have incidents like Gamergate, where someone will go on there and just have a mob take them down for no other reason than sexism or racism.
So there is this whole idea that Salesforce might buy Twitter. And Salesforce, of course, the CEO, Mark Benioff, finally killed all rumors. And he kind of led to the idea, and the reason why potentially was because Twitter – he didn't say this outright. He said – it's not the right fit for his company, referring to the price, the work culture, and those things actually contributed and other things. He didn't lay it out. But other people like Mad Money Jim Cramer said that he had inside information that it was really about this hate speech, this other stuff that's going on there, the harassment and all that. And Salesforce and other companies don't want to be associated with that.
Well, Twitter is this mixed bag. It was used during the Arab Spring for people to get the message out even when you had a repressive government trying to hold them back. So that is on the good part. And so Twitter has this banner of we want free speech. Well, there's a double-edged sword to free speech, which is
hate speech.
Hate speech is also in many cases free. and oftentimes too free.
But don't
– when I say too free, I mean too – people too willing to inflict pain upon others for no good reason.
Right. A case in point today, I just saw someone being attacked where their image was changed to be a bullet hole in their forehead and like blood on it. Like, so the photo's mm-hmm. modified and this
was
to their life.
This was a news reporter, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of – and of course that's – that entry is tagged with her name. So if you're following her and see her stuff, that shows up in your feed potentially, depending on how you follow her.
Right.
And
just to say this, this was a Trump supporter who was upset that this person who worked for the Arizona – I forget which – it was Arizona Sun-Times or the like.
Any but case.
It was a conservative newspaper, had mm-hmm. a conservative editorial board for years, had never endorsed a Democrat before, and they endorsed Hillary Clinton over Trump.
This last week?
Yeah.
Right.
And some Trump supporters in the area had just gone ballistic.
And started – and that's the thing that's kind of scary about that, of course, is that it's an audience base that knows her and is attacking her. I mean, it's pretty horrific. The thing is that kind of posting can be taken down relatively quickly after
right.
the fact. But it is a challenge. The thing I don't understand exactly is –
but once you jump into that Twitter – area, that sphere, you are now, if you own it, you now own the responsibility
right.
to try to mediate between all these effectively warring groups.
Do you think that's why it's been so challenging to get this change to occur? I mean, to improve the service for people? Like, why hasn't Twitter solved this problem? Is it intractable?
I think Twitter would need to make a change in how they're perceived. Like right now, their mantra is free speech uber alles. And they've been very cautious about doing anything to cut people off, to limit the people's access to Twitter. And that's been a double-edged sword. Like I said, it's helped out with regard to political dissidents because there are many countries out there that are saying we want to cut these people off. And Twitter has said what I think correctly in terms of principles, no. But it also lends toward, well, where do we draw the line, and do they draw it just because some people consider something hate speech and other people consider it free speech?
Yeah, it's hard to say.
It's something that Twitter has a dichotomy that's more so than many other places. The only other place I can think of that's even close to that would be parts of Reddit. But at least Reddit partitions its users quite a bit more.
Right.
Twitter is a free-for-all. Everyone is on the same level.
Well, additionally, Reddit content is normally contextual in a different kind of way. It's not surfaced the same type of way Twitter stuff is.
Right.
The feed for Twitter is very much flat and time-based and also, of course, content-specific-based.
Right.
And trends more. So, you know, hashtags are kind of a global way of searching stuff. With Reddit, you have to kind of get into the community a bit more. You have to go a little deeper and be a little involved.
Well, you choose the topic and then you go there. With Twitter, there is no topic. You choose people that represent a topic to follow. But that's about it. It's a lot more fluid with regard to interactions. It's even more fluid than Facebook because Facebook, you at least have to know the people that you're talking to.
Right. Hey, how often do you post on Twitter?
I've been doing a lot more lately.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because I haven't been on Facebook.
Yeah.
I find – it's funny. I have these split offs. I go to Google Plus when I want to really geek out.
Be by yourself?
No. No, no. It's actually quite refreshing. It's if you want to go for a technical discussion or things that are going through with Arduino or Raspberry Pi, it's a great place to be. If you want to talk about PostgreSQL, it's a great place to see what's going on. Twitter is still where a lot of lead web developers go to show new techniques. And so I have I'm having fun with that, seeing a lot of the new technologies going through mm-hmm. there. And it's not as much politics. Some leaks through, but it's at least for the feeds that I've been looking at, because they're mostly technical, I haven't been getting that. Then again, I am male, so I'm usually not a target on Twitter. So that I am fully aware of that privilege that comes along with it.
My pattern for social networks is that Facebook represents my local community, people I know directly and are not very technical. That's where mm-hmm. – so pictures of my kids are going to go up on Facebook to share with grandma. Twitter is completely work-related and technology-related. Like, if I'm talking about the show, I post new episodes, maybe potentially my site or to the GeekSpeak handle, but also just talk about tech in general or ideas that are more intended for a larger generic audience, not people that necessarily know me. That's kind of my – not that, you know, the same type of people know me on both services. Google Plus used to be really big for me because of Google Glass, and it's really easy to post there. But I find it a little challenging to get any kind of dialogue happening. I'm assuming you're using kind of pages on Google – what is it called?
Well, communities? Yeah, communities. Google Plus – I also have friends on there. So
right, from working there,
very,
you kind of
– yeah, very technical.
Sure.
Well, not just from working there, but yeah. But Google Plus back, you know, a few 5 years back was trying to be Facebook, and it just
didn't work.
And when they stopped trying to be Facebook and just started trying to be Google Plus, it became a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah,
it became a lot more a lot higher signal to noise.
Let's talk about artificial intelligence. We chatted a while ago and kind of argued in post-show about how possible it would be for artificial intelligence to get good enough to program. And I've talked to other people since then, and I'm still strongly in the camp that we're not even close to that. At the same time, I've listened to a lot of the ideas that within the next 5 to 50 years, we will probably have general artificial intelligence, and that will be a challenging growth into that space, severely challenging. Because once you get an ability to reproduce a human's intellect in software, you can run it faster and make more of them fast. So conceptually, a company that had a lot of resources at their hand and cracked the nut could potentially have tens of thousands effective more employees very, very fast. And that could change dynamic. And I'm just doing the simplest possible scenario. That could change the dynamics of the success of that company quickly. The general way of thinking about this is if you could take a Miles Elam and reproduce him in a server farm, like what are Google's server farms called, their locations?
What are their locations called?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like data centers?
Data centers. Okay. So it's, and how many do they have? Thousands of them, right? Something like that.
They have a lot.
They have a lot. So let's say you can take and make a Miles Elam in a data center. Google achieves this in the next 20 years. When that occurs, first off, the speed would be faster, right? It wouldn't be reduced to the speed of you. It would be
– So you wouldn't need a data center for that. You just need a single cabinet probably.
I'm trying to be – but let me say that a data center, let's say, can run Miles Elam 1,000 times faster than Miles, okay? So in one day, it's 1,000 days. In a week, it's 1,000 weeks. We're talking about an immense amount of potential that they can just turn on one of these – as many as they want, really. All the data farms could fill up with this. And if you think about Miles, you doing something over 30 years without sleep or need for anything else, maybe, of course, an artificial intelligence might need to daydream and do other things, who knows. But the amount of work you could achieve in such a short period of time would mean effectively that they would have tens of thousands more employees that were programming very, very quickly. And that kind of level is not the same kind of it's not a linear growth.
Right.
And that means that their strength would be they'd be much better than any company. And because it happens over a short period of time, within – if you're 3 months behind Google, you lose. And I'm just using Google as an example.
Sure.
It could be any company.
Sure.
So there is a real concern about what's going to happen when we get general artificial intelligence. And I'm not even talking about the potential of it having other intentions other than our own interest. Anyway, so I've been doing a little bit of research on that, and I thought that that was an interesting thing for us to talk about. And you had a story about artificial intelligence?
Yes. This was something that I was talking about with some friends the other night, actually, where they were talking about artificial intelligence, and I was saying, well, the idea of Skynet, this human-like intelligence that is malevolent and taking over and is really far away, not even on the horizon, let alone the mobility issues. That is pure fiction.
Right.
It's interesting fiction, but it's pure fiction. However, artificial intelligence, as we've been talking about before on the show, with machine learning and evolutionary algorithms and things where you put in a bunch of data and you say, I'm looking for this type of these patterns to get this type of result, you know, what's going to give me the best results according to this, these criteria. And then there's the black box where it munges the data and figures out the that we don't know what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And out pops, we see that you purchased this. And so you might be interested in this and this and this because people who are like you have some similarity. We don't know what those similarities are, just something
right.
mixed in.
And the analogy, the thing you just described is what Google's doing with image captioning that they just open sourced. We talked about last week. What Netflix is doing with giving you new movie recommendations. What Amazon is doing with giving you recommendations for what products.
Right.
All these have different levels of complexity, but the general idea is that that mush in the middle is powered by data coming in and feedback loops of that data.
Right. And this is also similar to spam filters back in the day.
Sure.
As they got better, you didn't know what they were actually matching on anymore. It turned out they were matching on like font color equals red type of thing.
But can I bring it back to the general intelligence sure. question thing for a second? We'll get to your story in a second. I just want to be clear about something. I personally do not feel there's anything magic going on in the human brain. There's no weird mechanical apparatus that we will not understand at some point. We get pretty close to understanding how neurons work. We're not so great in biology compared to silicon, but we'll get there. To the brain is nothing magical.
We're different from silicon, but yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But there's nothing magical happening in the brain. Mm-hmm. The brain is a machine that can process information. We have machines that can process information. We get better all the time at writing ways of writing software, and we get better all the time at hardware, and we get better at just understanding how to process information with new tricks and tools. And we continually progress that way. And one of two things is going to happen. At one point, those things that we've made will surpass the ability and capability of the human, or at least get to that point, maybe surpass it, or we will stop being technically savvy species. Both of those, I mean, the not being sex, you know, killing ourselves off or going into a dark age is a possibility, and that would stop this. But other than that, I see no way of this stopping. There's too much financial need and reason to do this. We will produce an artificial intelligence that's general in the sense that it will be comparable to a Miles Elam at some point.
Something passing the Turing test.
Yes. And that will change the way the world works. Whether that happens in 50 years or before, it will happen. And I don't think we're politically ready for that. Go on with your story, though.
Sure. But one issue that some computer scientists have is that, as one researcher puts it, we have a sea of dudes problem.
A sea of dudes problem?
Yes. Because while those data sets are those algorithms are pretty agnostic about, hey, we want to take this data and we're going to come up with this result and be more efficient at that result – it ignores the fact that the computer is the middle part. People are on either end. So
yeah, collecting the data, putting
curating
it in.
And vetting what data goes in,
and actually also approving the positive feedback loop aspects and the negative feedback
right.
loop aspects,
and deciding what your outcomes are supposed to look like.
Yeah,
because you have to do that as part of the problem. It isn't open ended like that. You say here is a target. And then here's all the stuff to go in.
And I'm assuming
all of that has bias. Human beings have bias. And so if all of the humans – and we're talking on the order of like 100 to 1. If you have 100 to 1 male to female curating this data that goes in dealing with what the results are supposed to be on the back end and to a large extent, fewer people of color than you might care for.
And you're basing that based off of the general, like if you do research on how many women versus men are in artificial intelligence fields or represent software, maybe not 1 to 100, but definitely 10 to 100.
No, actually in artificial intelligence, it's pretty close
oh, really?
To 100 to 1, yeah.
No. Okay.
If not worse. Right now, computer science graduates, I believe with women, it's somewhere around 17% of all computer science graduates mm-hmm. are women. And it used to be in the
32?
80s, I believe, 34,
yeah,
something
34.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's gone down dramatically. And I think there might be a slight uptick now, but mm-hmm. it's still
bad.
Low. Artificial intelligence is a rarefied version of computer science, although it's becoming more and more popular. And so that ends up being even more exclusionary.
Mm-hmm.
than other branches of it.
Well, so that means that we're already messing up with this artificial intelligence stuff, right?
Well, we've seen it already. When people have talked about – they do a Google search and the Google search comes back with something sexist or racist, and the response is – or it happens on Facebook also. And the response is we're going based upon the data we're getting, and the data we're getting is from crawling the web. So it's going to – the search results are going to be a reflection of – our society.
Right.
You know,
and that it, at any level of bias that existed at one time, it perpetuates because, mm-hmm. At one point, maybe a majority of websites were generated by men. And over time, that would skew all systems in place to such that there would still be a bias for content that was generated by men, even if we'd switched so that there was much more content being made by women.
Right. Microsoft made a bot. This was covered on the show a year ago.
That was less than that, but yeah.
And the bot went from cute little teenage girl to ranting, raving neo-Nazi in no time flat. And that was because the input she was getting was constantly pushing in that direction.
Yeah. So what's the solution to this problem? Or first off, of course, being aware that this is a problem. I have to say that if you're looking at this as a scientist, assuming that a lot of people that are in computer science have scientific backgrounds, mm-hmm. You definitely don't want that kind of bias to exist. Like that would be – if you were a rigorous researching scientist, you would try to remove all bias like that from your research.
And yet you'd be surprised how many scientists out there will actually believe themselves to be able to think their way out of
– bias?
Of sexism, for example, yeah. That they may go, oh, I might be sexist, but this is right here. This is objective. This is objective truth.
And you don't think that's reality?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. I don't think people can be objective really.
I mean, I think of psychology in the 50s and 60s, and I don't think that the psychologists of the 50s and 60s were dumb.
Right.
Or mentally impaired in some way.
They just had a worldview that supported what they said.
Right, because yeah. They were human.
Yeah. What kind of examples from the 50s are you talking about, like hysteria, things of that nature?
The experiments that would talk about how this proves that white males are more capable than everyone else.
Right.
You know, insert other group and this proves that this is better.
Basically, the science supporting the inequity of the time in its data.
Right.
Even you'd think that if it was pure, the confirmation bias was
strong. Yeah.
Right. And that still exists, of course, at any level.
Right. And that's where the confirmation bias with machine learning comes in that I worry about, which is the what you are looking for, what pleases you is not necessarily what pleases or gratifies or works for someone else.
Isn't the idea, though, of these systems to produce a success, and that success is based off of the user's feeling like it's successful? Like
but success based upon what? Because if you live hypothetically, let's say if you accept that we live in a sexist society.
I do accept that. Yeah.
But even if you don't, let's say hypothetically, let's say we're in a sexist society. So if that's the case, then the algorithms that would be the most successful are the ones that would cater to men.
Right.
Because women do not have the same economic clout.
So an example of this would be Facebook feeds promoting stories and making sure people stayed on the service more. If the feeds produce a slight bias to more pleasing to men experience and the society in general thinks of that as more mainstream and norm, then the system would continue to do that. Even if you're upsetting and subjugating people, because the society is already doing that, you wouldn't see in fact, if you didn't do that, you'd actually have a negative bias in your feed.
Right. And that – and I mean myself, I grew up in a society that still has racism as an issue. And as
where
such –
where was that?
I'm sorry. And as such, I myself can be racist. And I don't mean that in terms of I'm going out committing hate crimes. That's not how it manifests most of the time. For me, all the time. It doesn't manifest as a hate crime. But at the same time, my biases now would support, like, if you had two different inputs from Facebook, there may be times where I would accept the more racist version of two things that were in close proximity because one felt more like the norm, because the norm was an attitude of racism.
I noticed
to make it, to make it easier, the 60s. I mean, people can accept that, yes, the 60s were racist.
Yeah.
And in that time, if you thought of the algorithm that would work the best in that society, choosing one that would work today in our modern sensibilities about racism would completely fail back then.
Right.
And not because the algorithms were a failure, but because of the biases put into what your expectations are and your feedback.
The examples we're talking about right now, and I can just give another one for an example. You know, I'm a heterosexual male, and imagery of women, clothed or not clothed or scantily clothed, brings my eye. Like, I'm definitely more, I'll look at that, notice that easily than other things. And so in a Facebook feed, I have to make sure to be conscious about not clicking on stuff, because if I'm aware that that's the reason I'm clicking on it, right? I try not to do that, because I don't, and therefore my feed probably has less of that. I was raised as a healthy feminist, and I want to engage in that way in my world. But still, that bias is there all the time. Mm-hmm. So, but in any case, that and the examples you gave are all about the feedback system of the user getting provided by the algorithm, not about curation of the data in. Like,
On the contrary, because you're looking for how does this response, which gets the best response from your user base.
I guess what I'm saying is putting in 100% women to write those algorithms, the problems we just talked about would still be there. It doesn't have to do with the programming of it. It has to do with the data in and the feedback system, unless I'm missing something.
On the contrary, because there is going to be some moderation. If you had an all-black programmer team, how likely would it be that even if your algorithm came out with some stuff that was, neo-Nazi, for example, how likely would it be that the programmers would go like, you know what, that's not okay. Let's tweak this a bit to see if we can address that.
So you're talking about
– that's an extreme example. I'm not saying that white programmers wouldn't try to filter that out. It's just there's something with regard to your personal survival
But you're talking about – you're talking about the details in the algorithm that would be not
– or examining what data you're allowing in, yeah. What filters you're putting into the data that's –
an example would be like whether you should include geography or not as part of the input parameters,
yeah.
Or whether you should include time of day in the output – in the parameters. Like,
or include
those
Breitbart without any filters, yeah.
Yeah, but those decisions highly influence the output. I guess what I'm saying is, like, normally what I think of is kind of a data-driven and pure system. And I know that – but that's the thing is I understand that in reality, when you get down to the nitty-gritty, there's levers you pull. There's adjustments you make.
Well, a data-driven system, what data are you gathering? If you're trying to gather out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean at the ocean floor – that's going to be a different set of data. Once you're gathering it from a society, that's people, and that becomes a major bias.
So let's take the example, the simplest example of Amazon's ability to product, rating and all that. If you have 100 people that have purchased a product and only one of them returned it, then and there's another product that's very comparable in description, but 30% return that one. Then the system is going to suggest this title. If that's the only feedback you have, you're going to see the one that is not returned as much. So the bias there is whether the person returns it or not. That's basically the whether people bought it and whether people returned it is the only actual data you use in that situation. Mm-hmm. In that situation, I can't see a bias that would be because of sexism or racism or ageism. Like, I don't see how that data point, because it's just like one thing to toggle, could affect that. What you're saying is these algorithms are complicated enough that it's never just one input like that. It's like 700 different things that they're putting in, and they all have to weight different things. And the way they judge whether it's working or not is kind of looking at the output and make an assessment.
Right.
And that assessment allows your human mind to be non-objective.
And whether or not you decide that certain data sets that are out there in the world that we all, when we're looking at how to deal with the world, we filter out stuff that we consider unimportant. Mm-hmm. Even when you're talking about data science and you're trying to get as much information in there as possible, you still have some stuff that you're like, this is introducing noise into my model. That choice of what you consider noise, what some people would consider like, oh, this is introducing some weird aberrations in my data. Yeah. Some other person might go like, no, this is important information and it's causing this because this is important information that needs to be addressed.
Very cool. I mean, it's interesting to think this way that and it does make complete sense. One of the mantras I've had for quite a while is that the actual algorithms that are giving you Google results or giving you your Netflix movies recommendations, those things, at one point, every little bit of them was made up by people that understood them. But now that they've been developed for so long, the people that actually wrote those little bits have moved on, forgotten, left the company. Other people have modified and changed on top of them. And the systems get so complex that no individual would actually understand how the whole thing works perfectly. Like they are above and beyond the capability of the human brain at this point. Mm-hmm. And because of that, every one of those little tiny changes and layers and levers that have been pushed by humans that do have bias, of course bias is going to enter the system. It's just neat to think of it that way because you have to think of it as a relatively complicated system to understand that there could be bias in there that you couldn't account for and you can't account for except for trying to control the input levers.
Right. And now we're talking about the things that we have as a problem. How do you solve it? And that's a much more difficult problem. Do you just add women to an AI team? I'm sure a lot of people would bristle at that because they say, well, what about qualifications? At the same time, if all of your AI team are male,
you've got a negative, you have a disadvantage.
Are you sure? Well, not just that, but this comes to when I've talked with some folks about ethnicity with regard to employment in the tech sector. People have talked about, well, we want to have more people of color, but we don't want to compromise our standards. And it's a common refrain. And I think of, well, what about 20 years ago? Do you think that we were worse with regard to racism than we are today? And let's say they were. Does that mean that the people 20 years ago who may have been still good programmers, were they substandard because you had excluded some people of color from the job market?
Right.
You know, that. And the same holds for women. It's always held in terms of, we don't want to compromise our standards today, but how are you so sure that you weren't compromising your standards yesterday?
Additionally, even though we have a lot of research that says that the interview process where you do a technical interview is actually completely useless.
Yeah.
In the sense that Google did a giant study across a lot of research and actually randomly hired people that had failed those. And when they looked later at the people that have succeeded and people that had failed, it turns out that no one was predicting it well, except for like one guy was able to predict really well in this field. But in general, there's no way to predict from that technical interview, except that we still use technical interviews, which is crazy to me.
Well, because no one knows what else to do, because the idea of choosing randomly –
But you should just choose. But we should be choosing randomly.
Well, we are choosing randomly. But
no, we're not. We're choosing with this giant bias.
We're choosing people that look and sound and act like us.
Yeah, that we're comfortable with, and that's like it's the worst thing to do. But the thing that's so frustrating is that if you know that technical interviews are useless in that regard, and yet we still do them, and then we also say, oh well, we don't want to lower the bar. Well, actually, you're not. You don't have a bar.
Right.
You have no. You don't know what your real rate is, so you can't lower it. You don't know. It's so frustrating. To me, it seems like if you want people with some experience, you look at their history of experience, and you hire based off of that. Don't interview them. Maybe talk to somebody to find out how if they stayed at a company for a long time, that's pretty much a good enough reason. Like, it seems to me that would be a better way of doing it. Now, of course, that right there is still going to produce a bias towards white men in software, because if you look at in general and try to find people that have long history of software development, you're going to have larger set of white men. So
the programmer phenomenon. Yeah.
So the secondary problem with this, which I don't think we talk about enough, is that. It is – there's – I don't have a lot of history in this, so I don't bring it up very much, but there's – I have heard that there's quite a bit of data saying that actually having a diverse workforce makes you better at your job, like makes the, mm-hmm. the team better. So in that regard, it would make sense to give more money to people that are harder to find because of the diversity. You should pay women more so you can find them and bring them on board because you'll actually benefit from their feedback in the system. And I don't understand why we don't do that more. Meaning, it's not about – if you want to make sure the bar is high, just pay women a lot more than men because they're more rare in software. And then you get – does that make sense? You'll get the best, you know, candidates out there.
And then you have people saying, no, that's unacceptable. It's a funny thing. Whoever is the dominant group, let's say white males, I'll narrow it down. Yeah, I'll narrow it down to just say men. Because that computer science is really – I mean, and pure programming, that is
– Male-female is the biggest discriminator.
That if men end up getting paid more, you will hear some men going, well, are they better? Like all this stuff. Or just like, eh, that's the way it works out. Maybe they should negotiate better. Like a lot of excuses as to why that is acceptable. And if you go, well, we got to make sure that they're paid the same, that get another large block that says, okay, as long as they're being paid the same, everything is cool. As soon as you suggest, even hint that, hey, what if we paid women more than men? Suddenly pitchforks come out and torches. Wait.
Okay, not from me. Why?
Really? You've never noticed this before?
Well, no. I mean, I'm saying I don't have that instinct. My instinct is like if I'm working in a company and the company has certain goals and the goals they want to achieve are such and they spend money to achieve those goals, if one of those goals is to make a diverse population, then make spending more money on that population makes sense to me. Like that seems like a no-brainer.
Because the thought process that goes through there, and this comes to a competition level too, is if you have a sexist industry, which I'm just going to say, like
software engineering,
we believe
yes,
software development is a sexist industry. Then there is going to be an implicit bias to say, well, there are all these men here, and we're not all completely incompetent, so there must be some reason why women are consistently underperforming with regard to wages. But you don't get very upset about it, or I mean hypothetically, because it's someone else's problem.
Granted, it's really good.
When you have,
it's
when
easy
you have
for
humans
to do that.
When you have that personal ego getting touched to say someone else is going to get paid more than me for some arbitrary reason, which is sex or gender, then suddenly it's like, wait, but now I'm at a disadvantage. Now it becomes a personal reason. It ceases to become academic.
Okay. I guess I'm different because I just don't see
– this.
First off, I have to say that
– power never accedes its own power voluntarily.
Yes. Okay. Ever. I get that. At the same time, software development is such a complex thing that to feel like you're better than everybody else is stupid. Like – there's no way an individual can be like godlike in software development. It goes to the boundary of your own ability immediately. And so being egotistical with your skills around software development is, to my mind, is insane. Do you get that idea, Miles? I mean, do you see the idea that putting yourself saying I'm really great and I should be paid more when you're talking about software development, do you know anybody that should be paid more because they're amazing as a software developer?
Yes, through my career, yes, I've met people that I thought should absolutely have been better compensated.
I find people in the world around me where I'm like sometimes go, oh, wow, they didn't do that very well. And then next time I see them, I go, wow, they did something that I'm totally blown away by. That like continually happens with software development. Sometimes that, oh, that didn't do really well is my own software I wrote a while ago, right? And sometimes, you know, I feel like I'm doing great. And then, of course, later I'll look at it and go, wait, I wasn't. I mean, the level of complexity around software just seems to lead to this idea that you've got to understand that by how much you slept last night, your brain will not function as well as something else. So
yeah, try being a professional programmer when you have like a 2 or 3 year old.
Oh, forget it. That's hard. But because of that complexity level, because we're at the boundary of our cognitive ability, any deviation away from the norm of cognitive ability means a richer system. having four people work on something, it's not going to be four times as good. It's going to be 20 times as good because the people that bring stuff to the table, they bring different ideas that you couldn't conceptualize. And I see that all the time with software where, wow, that was, you know, Bill did an amazing job. Oh, Bill did a really crappy job. Wait, is Bill a good programmer? Oh, yeah, I know he does amazing work. He does crappy work. Oh, wow, it's really hard to do this. Mm-hmm. So to my mind, having four guys in a room talk about something or having two guys and two women, it's a no-brainer that you would do that. You would try to have as much deviation of thought process as possible. I don't think that actually people think that differently very much anyway. So you really have to grasp to try to get any kind of deviations. Yeah. Women and men do think, I mean, I do notice that they do think differently in some ways. So I could see that. But
well, experience matters for a lot. Experience within the tech industry is going to matter a lot for how proficient you are. It's just like if you're learning a foreign language. The more you use that language, the more you have access to a bunch of diverse people speaking that language, the better you're going to be at that language. And tech is exactly the same way. And at the same time, you have the experience that you have outside of your work that goes to play in your job.
Yeah.
And that's where diversity really comes to the fore.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And that even can do you can see that as the easiest way to see that is take a problem that you're struggling against, especially if you're a software engineer and you're working on a problem, and then stop for a day and come back the next day and see that the problem just goes away. You solve it instantaneously.
Or it changes.
And that's the thing is that you can – it's not all that's happened there is you've slightly changed your perspective by a little bit of time, mm-hmm. by bringing in your outdoor world, going out to dinner – talking with somebody.
More rest, less rest, just, yeah, something that distracts you.
Thanks, Miles. That was fun. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Apple. Apple has either moved or let go of people working on their car. So Apple has been kind of secretly, but not so openly secretly, working on an artificial driving vehicle, mm-hmm. probably electrical. They don't make any press announcement of it, but they kind of hint to it. Mm-hmm. And they've been hiring people, quite a bit of people, to work in this industry. And they recently just kind of shifted the focus of that entire project. Mm-hmm. And it looks like – and laid people off and moved people around. And their focus seems to be now instead of building a car, they actually are going to develop a system that other car companies could use. So not hardware and software at the same time, mm-hmm. software. What do you think?
Apple was never in the automotive business, so I was kind of surprised to hear that they were going to try to get into there because when you're trying to deal with NTSB regulations and yeah. actual real-world scenarios with regard to motor vehicles, it's a different class of problem than they've been working with regard to laptops. At the same time, there's a video I saw recently that I'll be putting up on the website for folks to look at and digest where a researcher was – thinking why energy and transportation will essentially be obsolete the way we think of it today by 2030.
Interesting.
And that seems like a very optimistic and just kind of woo-woo.
Hundreds of members of the car team were shifted or let go.
Sure.
But they were actually – it was comprised of 1,000 people. So they'd scaled up to 1,000 and they've just let go of hundreds. So tell me more about this.
Yeah. But he categorized an electric car compared to an internal combustion engine. An electric car has far fewer moving parts. You're talking about a motor on each wheel, the steering column, the pedals. Mm-hmm. So he was simplifying by basically saying 15 moving parts on an electric vehicle as compared to an internal combustion engine, which is, shall we say, much larger than 15.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of complexity in combustion vehicles compared to electric vehicles.
And
yeah.
the maintenance level for an internal combustion engine vehicle is quite high compared to an electric vehicle.
And the reason why we think of them as so reliable is we're really, really good at that because we've been doing it for so long. Mm-hmm. But electric cars can definitely be more reliable, much easier, though we're just learning about them.
Right. And you had a Tesla Model S, which was, I mean, not the earliest foray, but still like blew the competition away with regard to car and driver. And
the only challenge I have with my Nissan Leaf is the range. You know, it's about 100-mile range. Mm-hmm. And that means that sometimes, like the other day, we were going out gallery hopping all over Santa Cruz. And Maggie was like, no, let's not bring that. Let's bring the combustion vehicle. Mm-hmm. I'm like, but I want to drive it. And, yeah, but then we might be restricting what we can do, right? But that's just a technical flaw that will be resolved
right,
next year.
Right, the Chevy Bolt,
yeah,
which is coming out now. Yeah, it's already more than double what yours is.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, rub it in.
But, I mean, this is what we're talking about. And so it talks about batteries, 15% cheaper like every year for however long. So that curve is getting very slight. So the video I highly recommend watching because it will – or at least changed my perspective on a lot of things. But it very much led into Apple making cars seemed kind of ridiculous to me before, and now it's like, oh, I can kind of see it now, and wow, things really are going to change very soon.
Well, thanks. I'll definitely watch the video.
When you see things like solar power and the launch there, the effect of Uber and self-driving cars.
Yeah, it'll be changed quickly. I think when you say something like 30 years, you know, 2030, that's a long way with regards to technology. I mean, mm-hmm. You look at 30 years ago, people didn't have computers in their homes, right? Like we're talking a serious difference in that amount of time.
Right. And yeah.
And now people have computers in
their
pockets.
The comparison he was making was when there was a horse-drawn carriage, there were horses, you know, horse-drawn carriage, and then that one car on the road. And then 13 years later, it's a sea of cars and there's one horse.
Yeah.
I mean, that happened very quickly.
And that's definitely what will happen with electric vehicles and probably self-driving vehicles because they're almost already as good as humans.
Right.
And definitely safer. I'm a big camera man and I like Nikon as my camera of choice or iPhone. I use an SLR, a single lens reflex, which means a mirror blocks the light coming into the sensor and shoots the mirror up to an eye reticle that you look at. And then when you click the button, the mirror moves out of the way, exposing the sensor, and then it closes back down again.
That way what you see on the sensor is exactly what is – or what you see through the viewfinder is exactly what you're seeing through the sensor.
Theoretically.
Yeah.
Nowadays, of course, real-time viewing actually is even more so what you see through it. Mm-hmm. I just like being able to put my eye through the lens. And I know this is just something my kids will never care about because it's just generational. But anyways, you have a story about a Nikon SLR, and so I want you to make sure to cover that.
Yes. One thing that people use SLRs for is for astronomy, for looking at celestial bodies through a telescope.
Oh.
And there are many telescopes. A guy I was close friends with had Sebastian. Had a telescope that was on a motor, you know, and mm-hmm. It would track objects. You know, you could program it to say like
this. Could it connect an SLR to it?
I don't believe that one could.
I have a microscope modification that I can connect to my SLR, mm-hmm. my Nikon, and take photographs of microscopic slides, which is really cool. but not a telescope. That's
right.
Cool though.
But it's a hobby and a lot of people do it. A former coworker of mine at Google is really into this. One of the issues though is that with regard to the atmosphere and having heat, mm-hmm. you have some distortion of your view. But even looking at the camera itself, because the electronics in there, heat is going to cause problems.
Yes.
With regard to the clarity of the image. It's only going to matter for the fine details, but astronomy, especially for distant objects, is all about the details.
Oh, interesting. So when you actually take a photograph with low light settings on a Nikon or any kind of camera, you pump the ISO, a camera is a standard body thing. You pump that number up higher and higher and higher so that you can get more light effectively. Mm-hmm. But what you're really doing is just making the sensor be more responsive to any light. And that means that it actually gets more responsive to noise. So it gets grainier and grainier. Faster film is grainier, but also faster ISO on a digital camera is grainier. But that grain is actually – that noise is actually coming from, well, wherever noise comes from. And in our universe, it's distributed heat, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's a good way of thinking about it. How do you make a Nikon camera have less noise if you know that?
So an Italian company, Prima Luce, was saying, hey, let's take a Nikon D5500 and let's strap a Peltier cooler on it. A huge
– Are those things for processors that have electroplate that makes one side colder and one side hotter?
Yep, exactly.
Through electrical current?
Oh, and just cool. Straps it to the back of the viewfinder. So you can't really see as well except that you have the panel off to the side to be able to look
right,
at your image.
Right. The Nikon 5500 is one of the ones you'd pick up at like Costco or something. And that it's kind of the consumer line SLR, and that viewfinder moves out of the way, so you're actually closer to the back of the camera. And of course, the back of the camera is where the sensor is. On the other side of the plastic is where the sensor is. So they're strapping this giant heat suck,
yep,
on the back of the camera. How big is it? How much bigger is it? Let me see if
I can. It's as big as the camera itself.
It's like a toaster on the back.
Yeah,
that's
the dimensions
cool.
are
with a fan and everything.
Yes, the idea behind it though is that if you drop that temperature on there, you drop the level of heat, you're going to get a clearer photo. It's not for hauling around, you know, point and shoot at your family members at Thanksgiving. It's for something that stands alone, attached to a telescope, and usually you're using some type of remote shutter so that you don't bump it.
You know, yeah,
so that your own pulse won't cause a problem with
it. Yeah, and you're not even using a cable one, you're using a remote, you know,
exactly.
IR one, so there's no physical, because any kind of movement is going to cause blur and a shakes and all that horrible stuff.
And all it costs you is $2,400.
This is more expensive than the camera, by the way, quite a bit more.
But that's not unusual. For the camera world, you're going to pay a lot more than the camera for the lenses.
Yeah.
So it's just another... Well, if you're already paying for the camera and you're trying to do good astronomy photos and you're already paying for the lenses to do good astronomy photos, then this just ends up being another cost of entry.
Yeah.
I am curious to see what difference they see, what people see in there. The article that we link on the website has a side-by-side, and you can see a visible difference in the amount of noise. But I do wonder how much it will matter to anyone who isn't a professional.
Right. Hey, so Google is now helping you fact check lies and truths.
Yes, this comes on the heels of, I guess it was a year and a half ago or 2 years ago that Google started putting up fact checked items like, do vaccines cause autism? And instead of having the mob and all sorts of stuff, they just went like, no, here's the research. It doesn't.
Well, they also did page ranking based off of that.
Right.
So the more outrageous the claim, the less likely you would be ranked high. The more factual information ranked high. So they basically
how well you were cited as well, yeah.
They put a bias in knowledge in their finding data based off of factual information.
So what they're doing now is – and this is just in time for the election. They're now fact-checking news items that come on Google News in their feeds, where some headline will come up and it will talk about there's this crackdown on pregnant women. And then underneath it with the text, fact check. And
a link to the actual information.
Yeah.
And where are they getting their factual information? Because, of course, that's all about reading research, right? I mean, it's kind of hard to know.
Well, there are fact check organizations. And leaving aside the number of people who – now believe that fact-checking organizations have a liberal bias. And it does go both ways sometimes, but for the most part, every time I've heard it has a bias, it's because someone doesn't like what's being said.
You know what? Google's actually looking at markup of the pages for source information and helping it determine that. So it's using metadata from the pages, which you got really into recently. Maybe we'll talk about that. Was there more of the story you wanted to cover?
No, that was it. This also brings to mind that notion of what are you doing with machine learning and AI, because this is what it is doing. It's looking at all this data and then trying to collate what it considers to be
factual,
more reliable information. Yeah,
yeah. I'm wondering if there's like a source of truth other than just crawling the net. It kind of makes sense that you'll get some level of knowledge, but they basically have to weight some areas higher than others.
Right. But this is a case where they are pulling a lever consciously.
Yeah.
Because when they weren't, you had a whole lot of articles coming up on Google searches saying, yeah, here's how vaccines cause autism.
Right.
And it was galling to a lot of people going, no, that's not the case. We can't just put in the data from a biased source and expect the output to be as useful.
It's a lot of power though.
It is.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Reuse our stuff any way you like. Just let them know we said hello. Thanks very much to our patrons who help us all the time by supporting us financially. If you'd like to learn how to do that, you're welcome to do so by going to geekspeak.org/support. While you're there, visit the website. See all the data we talk about, all the shows, all the mentions and stuff we talk about, we put up on the website with information. And it's also in your podcast feed, assuming you have a podcast player that is awesome. I want to thank our support geek, Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, White House Bot Notes. Trolls, lies are cool, dude. You think I read that right? Michael Newman of Potstar Music for providing our theme song. Thank you so much. And thank you for being here for episode 43 of season 16.